This is Elise here with episode 2 of the Real Scary podcast. If you're joining me again, thank you so much, and I hope you enjoyed the first episode. And if you're a new listener, welcome, and I hope you enjoy. Today, I'm going to be talking about Fernie. I was actually going to make this a two-parter, but then I decided I would just give it all to you in one episode. And I'd like to start off by first sending a big thank you to Lindsay from the Fernie Museum for sending me some amazing and in-depth information for these stories. And I'm excited to let you know that the Art Center is planning on running the ghost tours on demand this fall. So the dates have not been solidified, but check in on their website closer to September for the updates. I have a feeling that after listening to this episode, you're going to want to go see these places in person. So I will put up a link to their website on my blog for episode 2, so you can check that out after. So I'm going to be telling you about 4 locations today, and I actually feel like I need to give a bit of a disclaimer. So I really strive to present the facts in a respectful way, so please know that the point of this podcast is to never hurt or trivialize anyone involved. The last episode, The Lost Cemetery, deals with the very difficult situation of disturbed grave sites. And unfortunately, families that to this day are still without the knowledge of where their loved ones are buried and whether or not they're still at peace. So this is not a story that I take lightly. Yes, the paranormal events are really interesting, but the underlying story is sensitive to say the least. So if anyone's listening who's involved in this story and has a missing loved one, I hope they will not feel any offense. So first off, for those who might not be familiar with Fernie, it's a little picturesque city nestled in the Rocky Mountains in the southeast corner of British Columbia. Fernie has a lot to offer, from the beautiful landscape to the incredible winter sports. This is what drives people to the mountains every season, and Fernie is well known as being a resort town. Fernie really began as a coal mining town in approximately 1898, and as the town grew, logging became its second largest industry. The town's history is not without tragedy, however. In 1904, there was a fire that claimed the mostly wooden main street. Then, in 1908, a second fire proved to be devastating for the town of Fernie. The fire moved so quickly through the town that the residents ran for their lives as the fire literally leveled the town in a mere 90 minutes. So it's at this point that we're brought to the first story. West Fernie was hit first in this awful fire that was later called the Great Fire. The fire raged, and as I mentioned, very quickly. Some people jumped into the nearby river, some ran ahead of the flames across the bridge, but some simply didn't have time to do either, and unfortunately they lost their lives to this fire. After the fire raged through and destroyed everything but a few buildings, the survivors who had sought refuge in neighboring towns made their way back to assess the damage and to search for missing townspeople. An entire family was noted as some of the missing. Walter Ford and his wife Maggie and their 2 young sons, Willie and Theo, lived in West Fernie on what is now known as Hartley Street. The townspeople hadn't been able to account for the Ford family, so they made their way to their property to search for any sign of what might have become of them. The search was proving to be fruitless until one unlucky party lifted the lid on the deep stone well in the backyard, and it's there that he made a grisly discovery. The Fords, like the entire town, were caught completely off guard by this fire, and they, like the few other casualties, found themselves without an escape route. With flames closing in and in a last-ditch effort to save themselves, the family looked to the well. And honestly, I probably would have done the same. Thinking that the stone walls and cool water below the flames would be their best bet, they lowered their children and themselves into the well. Tragically, it didn't prove to be the safe place they hoped for, and the entire Ford family perished. Legend has it that the family had essentially boiled to death. Though Lindsay points out, it's much more likely that they suffocated before their bodies would have been charred. And actually, I think this is more accurate. In the Ford family's tragic last moments, Walter attempted to shield his family from the flames and the stifling heat, and his body was found draped over theirs. Now, something that I try to do with all the stories that I hear when possible, and as you saw in the first episode, is try to back it up. And in this case, just as Lindsay had said, it was actually very well documented. So I will post all of the articles that I found on my website under episodes, blog post, episode 2. So one of the articles that I found is from the Edmonton Bulletin dated August 5th, 1908, just 4 days after the fire, with an excerpt about the Fords, and it reads, "A man named Ford and his wife and 2 children took refuge in a cistern and the fire burned to the water's edge. The man's head was scorched to the shoulders and the remainder of his family were suffocated." So, awful. And it does prove, I think, that Walter died taking the brunt of the damage to protect his family. In the days and weeks that passed, the town, of course, mourned the loss of all the victims, and the Ford family was buried together in the St. Margaret's Churchyard, where they remain today. Their home was burned along with most of the town, but the well remained on the property and is still there to this day. Eventually, another home was built, and the well was filled and covered as it was no longer of use, but I'm sure it was also an attempt to keep the tragedy in the past. However, it appears the youngest Fords hadn't quite moved on. For the next 70 years, homeowners of the old Ford property reported hearing children's voices shouting, laughing, and playing in their backyard in all seasons of the year, but especially in the summertime. Of course, upon further inspection, no children were ever in sight. Reports of things moving in the backyard were also common tales. But perhaps the most unnerving to the new homeowners were the occasions where they would see little childlike shadows darting between the trees surrounding the house as if playing an eternal game of hide and seek. In the 1970s, a séance and spiritual cleansing was performed by a spiritualist in an attempt to reunite Willie and Theo with their parents. And it appeared to work. After this, the hauntings have since ceased. My next story takes place in Coal Creek, which is not too far from the city of Fernie. To get to the Coal Creek Heritage Trail, you will find the gazebo, not far from the Fernie Aquatic Center, and from there the trail follows an abandoned railway line to the uninhabited ghost town. Coal Creek was once a bustling mining community between 1898 and 1858, with up to 1,000 residents. In April of 1912, a miner by the name of Richard Benson, or commonly known as Dick Benson, went to his superintendent to complain. He said that his fire boss, who went by Joyce, and I'll say I didn't know this, but a fire boss is basically an official in charge of safety in the mine. So he said that Joyce had moved him from his regular station in the mine where he'd worked for years and had done so out of spite. The superintendent said that he would talk to Joyce, but he wasn't sure there was anything he could do. On Sunday, witnesses saw Benson take off his coat and challenge Joyce to a fight. But Joyce refused, stating he would not fight on a Sunday. The following evening, still upset and having been brooding over this issue, Benson went to the local bar to drown his frustrations in a few drinks and then made his way home. Benson was living with a man named John L. Atkins and his wife. John's wife tried, but without success, to cheer up Benson, telling him to try not to worry about the quarrel. Benson just couldn't let it go and ended up leaving. Shortly after that, Atkinson saw that Benson's revolver was missing, and he left to go look for him and to warn Joyce, as he stated in a police interview, if Benson met Joyce, there would be trouble. Sadly, Atkinson did not find his friend, and Benson went back to the mine office to confront Joyce. He found him just where he thought he would be, and when Joyce turned, Benson shot wildly and ran off. Luckily for him, but unbeknownst to Benson, Joyce had just been hit in the elbow and was fine, albeit a little bit of shock, but he was alive. Benson was found half an hour later beside the railway tracks, revolver still in hand, and dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound to his head. What's even more tragic than him taking his own life and dying thinking that he was a murderer? The superintendent had spoken to Joyce and demanded to put Benson back in his old position. The judge in the whole proceedings gave his final verdict in the case as found in the newspaper from the time, and I quote, that the deceased Richard Benson met his death at Coal Creek, East Kootenay, B.C. about 11:30, April 22, 1912, by a bullet through the brain, having shot himself while temporarily insane. Reading the newspaper article at that time, and I'll include the entire article in the episode 2 blog, it seems like Benson actually had the sympathy of the courts. Each witness spoke very highly of him. He was kind, he was level-headed, and a good worker. His funeral was one of the largest attendances the town had ever seen. It seemed like even the other higher-up bosses and the judge thought that he was wronged by being pulled off this position for no apparent reason. Sure, the way he went about taking out his frustration was extreme, to put it lightly, but I can't help but wonder how the trial would have gone if Benson had not shot himself. With a verdict citing temporarily insane, you have to wonder if he would have walked. But we'll never know. It seems that Benson just hasn't been able to move on from the location of his very sudden and tragic passing. Long after the town and its people are but a memory, stories of Benson haunting the old stretch of tracks remain. People have reported hearing eerie sounds or a far-off gunshot. And one couple was walking one night and reported feeling cold hands on them, pulling them back toward the side of the mountain. An elderly man was walking late one night when he saw a shadowed figure of a man in a flat cap standing beside the tracks. In a very Canadian attempt to be polite, he said hello, but when the man raised his head to look back at him, he saw that below the brim of the flat cap was a gaping hole where his face should have been. The man, despite his age, ran as fast as his legs would carry him. And I don't blame him, I would have shit my pants. This brings us to our next story, which is the Fernie Courthouse. So oddly enough, the Fernie Courthouse was one of the buildings that was destroyed in the August 1st fire in 1908. The new courthouse was finished in 1911, and it's stunning. It really is a beautiful building. I will have some photos in the blog post for this episode, and you'll see just how picturesque it looks, nestled in the mountains. But as Lindsay put it, it has seen 108 years of the worst human misery that Fernie has to offer. So hauntings and ghost stories are not surprising for this property. Now, the basement cells were designed to hold a maximum of 6 prisoners. But as with a lot of places from this time, just because that was the maximum does not mean that 6 is where they stopped. If they needed to put more, they did. The Fernie Courthouse took on cases from all of the surrounding areas. And the offenses ran the gambit from theft to brawls to first-degree murder. And with so many cases, these cells were more often than not over capacity. Sometimes each cell would hold 15 to 25 prisoners. So as I said, in a cell that was supposed to hold 6, it would hold 15 to 25 prisoners huddled together on the floor. The conditions were far from sanitary, and as you can imagine, the smell, especially in the summer, was unbearable. Journalists called it Fernie's Black Hole. Today, the basement is, as you would imagine it, used for storage, and the cells are no longer in use. Cleaners late at night have reported hearing footsteps, breathing, and sobbing. Heavy doors in the basement have opened and closed on their own, and have even been known to rattle with no earthly explanation. I don't know about you guys, but I would not be able to work there by myself, so I give a big pat on the back to the janitors that work there. The second floor courtroom has regular unexplained events. About a year ago, one of the cleaners, those poor cleaners, he was working late one night and decided to record his experiences with his phone. The other cleaner he was working with was outside, so he knew he was alone in the building. He took a video of the second floor, and when he played it back, the video captured quick footsteps. It sounded as if they went down the hall and then disappeared. He also took several photos of the inside of the courthouse, and they revealed a tall, white, smoky figure in the shape of a man. It was standing between the jury box and the witness stand. He also downloaded a ghost hunting app on his phone. Now I can say, I can't comment on the validity of these apps. Who knows if they actually work or not, but the purpose was to pick up EVPs. So for those of you who don't know, an EVP means an electronic voice phenomenon. People believe that sometimes a spirit voice can be picked up on a recording device when otherwise not heard by the human ear. Anyways, he was walking the courtroom with his ghost hunting app, and when he got to the top of the stairs, he heard a clear voice emerge from his phone, and it said, "He pushed me." He waited again to see if anything else came through. And just as he was about to turn away, the voice spoke again and said, "After you." I think what is positive about this piece of evidence is that the voice can be related to the area that he was in. So, though I will say truthfully, I'm a little skeptical just because of the fact that it's a phone app, the things that it said did coincide with where he was standing. So it's possible that it's real. Finally, we move to the third floor, where a staircase leads to the judge's chambers and a bedroom where the judge could stay overnight. One of the city employees walked up these stairs alone, and when he entered the room at the top, the door slammed shut behind him with immeasurable force. He explained it away with a possible breeze or just a quirky old building. When he was ready to leave, however, the door wouldn't open. He pulled and pulled and pulled with all of his strength, but it wouldn't budge. But it was then that he realized that as he was pulling, the door didn't feel like it was jammed. It had a little give, and it felt as though there was someone on the other side holding it. So suddenly the room was plunged into darkness, and he was left there panicking. He felt along the wall, trying to find the light switch in the darkness. He was certain he heard voices on the other side of the door. He couldn't make out what they were saying. The voices were hushed and whispered, and he even thought he heard laughter. So now he's thinking, okay, someone's playing a prank on me. He flipped the switch and he ran to the door, and it opened easily, but revealed an empty hallway. Convinced that maybe they were able to quickly run off, he searched the top floor, but no one was there. Spooky, I love it. Love this story. I would have been curled in a ball in the corner until somebody found me, but that's just me. So let me know in the comments what you would have done in this situation. So that brings the courthouse to an end, and we're now moving on to the last story in our Fernie episode. So this last story out of Fernie sounds like a horror movie, and one in particular, Poltergeist. So this is actually one of my favorite movies of all time, the original, obviously. But I never thought it could be a real life situation for a lot of people. So now, this has nothing to do with kids being sucked into TVs, but it does have to do with a beautiful, upscale, suburban community built on top of countless graves from what was once the town cemetery. So how could this happen? In real life, in the real world, how could this happen? So before the 1890s, the inhabitants of Old Town Fernie buried their dead in a town cemetery near what is now Level Crossing. When the railway came through, the area became so crowded and overtaken by acidic fumes from the coke ovens. Now, coke was the fuel in the early days of steam locomotives, so I'll put a little more information about this on the blog. It's kind of interesting. So the graves were moved up the hill to somewhere more peaceful. Well, this was the plan. But as we will come to learn, these poor souls have not had a peaceful rest. There's a subdivision in Fernie called Ridgemont, and this is actually where the rest of the story takes place. In 1972, the city decided to build this subdivision and an elementary school. Well, the perfect location was on top of the former graveyards. Some of the old markers were respectfully cordoned off by fence to protect them, and they're still seen today in surrounding areas. But as the construction began and they started to dig, they found bodies and gravestones. In the beginning, they would exhume and rebury the bones, but there were just too many for them to contend with. Personally, it sounds like laziness. They just didn't want to. The time it took to be respectful and respectfully deal with all of these remains was throwing off their deadlines. So by the end of the project, they were apparently just bulldozing grave markers, workers who dug the foundation for the school, used to tell stories of human skulls popping out of the foundation walls, or of headstones just rolling off the edge of the bulldozer blades. I have to say, this sickens me. I can't even imagine how this was just okay. And even for the people that it wasn't okay with, I can't imagine going to work and doing this and just looking the other way. And I'm sure for everyone, it wasn't easy for them. But you have to think that no wonder there's paranormal activity here when there was just this blatant disrespect for these graves. So it really just, it doesn't even seem real. It's crazy that this actually happened. And in a Global News article that I found from 2014, they spoke with a worker named Vern McGarrigle. I hope I said that right. Who was one of the workers on the site. And he said that the first time they found remains, the whole site was shut down and authorities would not let them go near it. So naturally, the company didn't want any more lengthy shutdowns. As I said, it was a deadline issue. So for the next few times that they found remains, they just, quote, pushed them aside and buried them so they were out of sight, out of mind. He goes on to say that this is just how it was. No one wanted to stop working. If they stopped, they didn't get paid. So in 2008, when the school was coming down and they were putting in the new Silver Ridge subdivision, they found the bodies of two men, a baby, and a little girl around 8 years old. The little girl was still wearing a knitted sweater with mother-of-pearl buttons and holding the remains of a rosary. This one in particular really breaks my heart. To have a child die is already horrible, tragic, awful. And her family carefully chose that clothing and that rosary to be laid to rest with her for all of eternity, they thought. And I don't even know if she ever ended up being identified. One of the men still had an American quarter in his pocket, and after all of the digging and construction above him, he ended up only 6 inches from the surface. 6 inches. And to top it all off, his body was cut in half as they dug the power lines for the school. How can you dig power lines and go through a body and not see that you just cut a body in half? Did they just rebury him in a shallow grave? There are almost 400 unaccounted burials. We aren't talking small 40-person cemetery here. This was a cemetery that serviced the community from pre-1890s to 1972. So that's over 80 years of burials. In Ridgemont Crescent alone, there are at least 96 burials unaccounted for. And most likely, there are many homes in that subdivision with bodies buried underneath. Under their home, their driveway, their backyard, their streets. So with all of this turmoil and disturbance for these poor souls, as I said earlier, it's no wonder there's paranormal activity here. Near the top of Ridgemont Drive, there is a house. I'm not going to say the number, but I have seen this little house and it's tiny, it's unassuming. And when they were excavating the sewer line behind the house, workers found a chunk of an old gravestone that had been bulldozed and then reburied during construction. The current owners moved in the early 80s with their son and daughter. The children both told their parents about two men in the kitchen. There were two of them, and the kids told them they looked sad. Mom and dad, of course, thought it was just kids being kids and dismissed it as that. One night when Mom got up in the night to go to the washroom, she saw the shadowy figures of two men standing in the doorway between the living room and the kitchen. She described them as wearing old-fashioned long coats and flat caps, and one was slightly shorter than the other. She stared at them, and they looked in her direction, but not really at her. And then she watched them turn and walk through the wall in her kitchen. The owner admitted to Lindsay she does not believe in ghosts. She has never and still doesn't believe in ghosts, but she's very adamant and completely certain that she and her children saw what they saw. She has no idea who they could have been, but she did say that if they were ghosts, they were probably buried under the house. I'm sure there are many, many, many more stories in this neighborhood, and I would love to hear them. So if you live in Fernie and you're listening, hi, and thinking, hey, I know a story from that area, please email me at realscarypodcast@gmail.com. Lastly, before I go, I want to tell you guys about an awesome group called Cornerstone Supernatural. They are based out of Vancouver, and I'm quoting from their site here, are driven by a single goal, to do our part in seeking out the paranormal, regardless of what it might be. So they're booked solid for the next 2 years with investigations, but they're going to do an interview for episode 7. So this is really exciting. I can't wait. I have pages of questions. So if you've ever wanted to ask a paranormal investigator anything, now's your chance. I will be doing a Q&A with Paul Bush, the director of the group. So please send your questions to my email as soon as possible at realscarypodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you tune in next time. The next episode will be coming out on Tuesday, July 23rd, and I'm hoping for weekly Tuesday releases after that. Episode 3 is all about haunted theaters, and one of my favorite stories and backstories so far is in that episode. I'm really excited for you guys to hear it. In the meantime, please check out my blog for episode 2 so you can see all of the photos and collected evidence for these Fernie stories. If you haven't liked my Facebook and or Instagram pages yet, head over there and give them both a like. They can be found at Real Scary Podcast. And lastly, please subscribe to my podcast and hit the like button on any platform that you're listening on so I can continue doing this. I have some amazing stories coming up, so I can't wait for you guys to hear this, and I really want to keep bringing them to you. Until next time, this is your friendly neighborhood host, Elise.